We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 039.EZ4705, certificate number 36634. The Ambassador Bridge.
Now, I know you're a capitalist.
Absolutely.
And you believe strongly that capitalism is the best.
Do you not read my
system?
Do you not read my blog, Marxist Dad? I've got lots of tips for the Marxist dads out there.
Marxist dads, what are some of your tips?
it really doesn't work out.
Being
a Marxist dad in our modern culture.
It's a little bit of an uphill battle. But capitalism, I don't want to shock you or our future listeners to say that capitalism, left unfettered, often produces surprisingly inefficient results.
You're not supposed to say that.
I know. You want to think?
I mean, I guess the libertarians weren't donating on Patreon anyway, so.
No, that's true. They believe that we should lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
I can't believe these guys want money for their show. So we're not going to lose any income by saying that we think this. But yeah, the 20th century has kind of been a series of, I mean, I know we have to see it as the failure of communism, but you can also see a bunch of terrible excesses of the capitalist way of life as well.
Yeah, and one of the dangers of capitalism, of course, is monopoly. Right, monopoly is what results when one ambitious and avaristic capitalist decides to corner the market on a thing, a product or a service, and
he's avaristic.
Avaristic. Avaricious.
Oh, yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, avaricious is the word.
Avaricious sounds like a blaxploitation movie. I'd go see Avaricious.
Avaricious.
He's the private dick who's a sex machine to all the chicks.
Yeah, avaristic. It sounds more like altruistic.
He's part avaricious and part atavistic or altruistic.
Atavistic. But there are plenty of instances in the 20th century and 19th century, where we see that that letting the market make the decisions doesn't always produce the most efficient results.
I mean, I feel like we're living in a time where a small group of people have figured out how to make those rules work for them and only them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because money begets money, right? If you have money, you make money, and if you don't have money, you don't end up being on the side of you don't end up being on the victor's podium, right? Even in good court cases, I mean, it generally tends that money collects. But in the United States, transportation was often a way for money to accrue unto a family or unto a corporation, because the United States is a big country. And we produce a lot of goods and services, but also natural resource exploitation, like transportation, trucking.
Got to get it around.
And trains and
railroad
shipping.
Money, right?
That's right.
It like in my favorite book, Atlas Shrugged.
Well, and in our, we've done a couple of omnibuses on the sort of various, the way that the land was apportioned to railroad companies.
Checkerboarding.
Checkerboarding is right.
CF checkerboarding.
Early on in the omnibus. So transportation ends up being, it's an aspect of the global economy that we, that becomes kind of invisible to us. I mean, we're very aware of trucks on the highway, of ships on the ocean, but the idea that it's all an interconnected infrastructural kind of web of, that those trucks on the highway aren't just annoyances, they aren't just obstacles, and they aren't just point-to-point systems, but that, you know, ships lead to trains, lead to trucks, lead to vans, lead to your Amazon bringing you your little whatever Furby.
The box of replacement staples I ordered in its own box with padding.
Right.
You can see how quickly store shelves empty in the case of an emergency, you know? Like if a city thinks a storm is coming or a blackout is coming or whatever, shelves are just empty within days.
Well, within, yeah, hours.
Hours. Same thing can happen with fuel. It happens with a lot of commodities. And you realize, you just assume there's always going to be every brand of marshmallow and every brand of cereal will be right there for you because we're entitled awful people.
Right.
Because of the corrosive effects of capitalism.
Well, but,
and you don't realize that 100 people, thousands of people have been working hard to make sure that got to you.
And it's one of the most popular refrains in the apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic crowd, the preppers and the, the bunker builders. They're quick to remind us what a fragile system that is, and quick to say, like, in the event of a catastrophic event, an earthquake, any kind of like breakdown of society, that once the grocery store is empty and don't fill back up again, we really are on our own, and the web is exactly that fragile.
And I am totally that person who just thinks of the grocery store as an aquifer that will just keep producing marshmallows to the edge of the shelf, and no matter how many I take, they're just going to keep coming out the back. And that's not how supermarkets work.
No, and in fact, my mom is the opposite. I mean, you would be maybe having heard a little bit about my mom, futurelings would not be surprised to learn that at 85 years old, she has 4 years worth of stores in her basement bunker, duffel bags full of Top Ramen, and
she had a hard scrabble upbringing.
She did, and she's ready for the big one. She bolted her house to its foundation. She's said to me many times, like, I intend to help our neighbors, so don't close this blast door and lock it. We're the people we know in the neighborhood are also welcome in the bunker. And I'm like, Mom, that's not how bunkers work.
It's not a bunker if everybody's in there. It's like one of those lounges at the airport.
Yeah.
The only fun is that not everybody can get in.
She wants both sides. She wants to have food for our family for the 5 years it takes to reestablish contact with the outside world. But she also would never not answer the door.
I had a bunch of drums of cracked wheat, but do you know what happened?
What?
I left them in your garage or your barn, I think, as a bit of set dressing. And now you sold your barn.
Yeah, that's
somebody
right.
Just inherited all my cracked wheat.
The new owners have all the cracked wheat.
Did you put that in the listing? Do you like Jeopardy? Do you like cracked wheat? Because
how would you like Ken Jennings' bundle of cracked
this
wheat?
This is the barn for you. So yeah, if things go wrong, I'm just, you know, putting my stuff in a bindle and walking to your barn.
Yeah. Well, no, come to my new house, because that's where I'm replenishing all the stores.
Is that where the bunker is?
No, the new bunker. But the system is more fragile than even even this, right? We think about a catastrophe, something that shuts the system down and we're all frantically scrambling. But as you mentioned, we see in the event of a hurricane, we hear apocalyptic scenarios about the state of Florida all the time, where it wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take seas much higher than they already are to wash out whole communities there, or to isolate the entire state of Florida into a, or in the case of
You're
California,
making this sound like a plan,
you know, like, right. Isolate.
I've figured out
then,
how to do it.
Then destroy, California.
Sure.
Is always, it seems like, just a few days from being in a truly desperate situation. But But our network is even more fragile in that the collapse of one or two bridges, one or two raggedy old bridges, would be enough to shut down commerce between, you know, like there was a freeway bridge that collapsed in Minnesota a few years ago in Minneapolis. That was just an example of decaying infrastructure that hadn't been maintained.
Everybody knew, right, that this bridge was kind of in bad shape.
Totally shabby bridge, and when it collapsed, it had a dramatic economic impact on the region because it was a main thoroughfare where
you just take it for granted that today rivers are not an obstacle, you know?
Right.
And then the past civilizations would have like been built around the idea of rivers as impassable, impregnable, you know, you got to have a ferry or a ford or something. And today, you know, it's an annoyance when a bridge backs up because, oh, I'm going to have to go around to the other highway.
Right.
Do you remember that, the bridge north of Seattle? What river is that?
It's on the Skykomish or the Snohomish River?
I think it's the Skykomish. And it turned out it was when that bridge collapsed, I-5 over that little river.
Yeah.
It turned out to be the only bridge for miles in either direction. And that just kind of stopped the region.
It's really tough to get around that. Yeah. Yeah. And that was an example of just a big truck that hit the truss and knocked it into the river.
So transportation is not the solution, it turns out.
Well, and if you think about
trucks are knocking out their own bridges.
Like if there are two tunnels and a bridge that lead into Manhattan from New Jersey. And they're all extremely vulnerable. When
this is the plot of the third Batman movie.
when 9/11 happened, you know, the threat of those bridges, or I'm sorry, those tunnels being flooded, was a real. I mean, it would have represented a much greater disaster.
When you're talking about how fragile these bridges are, you're not encouraging people to take them out and to create their own fiefdom in some part of this great land.
No, if we are going
to... That certainly happened, future listeners know, but it wasn't because we encouraged it.
When Manhattan gets turned into a giant prison island, at that point, you're going to have to
Manhattan was a giant prison island between 1978 and about 1990.
Like 72. But... One of the choke points, one of the most kind of outrageous and interesting bridges in the United States is the Ambassador Bridge between Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Canada, Windsor, Ontario.
Ontario. I've never heard of this bridge. Well, I know the trivia fact about how Detroit is the one weird place. Windsor, I guess, is the one weird place in Canada where if you go north, you're in the United States.
Yeah.
Go due south from almost anywhere in Detroit, and you're in Canada because of, it's. I don't know what to call that little tendril of Canada.
Isthmus, a little, the point, the southernmost tip of Canada, I think they call it.
It's got a weird, it looks like a nose or something, like kind of sniffing it at the mitten of Michigan.
Yeah, I think of it as maybe the waddle of like a giant,
it's got prongs. India bull. It's like Canada's poking us with a fork. Like, America, you're done.
It's in there. It's getting up under us. Like it's a little tickle.
It's cupping Detroit. Stop cupping Detroit. Detroit didn't consent to that.
The Detroit River separates Ontario from Michigan, but it also is part of the Great Lakes Greater Waterway.
Sure, it connects two of the Great Lakes, right?
It connects Lake Huron to Lake Erie, right. And Lake Erie is the lake that goes, you know, that is the northern border of Ohio, and Lake Michigan on the far side between Michigan and Illinois, and then Lake Huron is between Michigan and, you know, northern or sort of, I'm sorry, southern Ontario.
Michigan and Huron is all a fraud, by the way. They're really one lake.
Yeah, I know.
There's nothing that would make you say those are two lakes.
Well, there's that point where they narrow.
Right, but nobody would go to Angle Lake is south of Seattle and be like, these are two lakes that meet at a point. There's tradition and probably the order in which they were discovered is why we think of them as being five great lakes.
They come to a little waste at Mackinac City.
Yes.
And they hang down on either side like a yoke. Not a yoke.
I was really worried about what you were going to
like
say.
Like a yoke. Not like two giant bull testes, but like a yoke.
Mm.
I like to identify geographical features according to what part of a bull they represent.
Don't we all?
in this sense.
Like Bulgaria, Belize, Belarus?
You know, no, the crazy thing is that that if you're going to call those two separate lakes, why in the world don't you call Georgian Bay its own Georgian Bay, which is a
sure.
which is a part of Lake Huron? Why the heck isn't it its own lake?
Let the record show that John was lifting his bifocals to peer at the map to give us this update on the autonomy of Georgian Bay. Yeah.
But there was a shipping, I mean, this was all a shipping route in the era of the Erie Canal and when boats did the lion's share of the heavy lifting, the commerce of basically the American Midwest, all of the grains and the cattle and the agricultural output of the entire Midwest had to get to the Eastern Seaboard some way.
Did it all go on the Edmund Fitzgerald?
Well, no, that was before the Edmund Fitzgerald, but
'cause that would be bad.
But before the railroads, this was how all that
St. Lawrence Seaway.
That's right. All the wealth of the breadbasket went out through this route. And
that's
shipping,
why we sing about the Erie Canal.
We do. Although the Erie Canal, we should do an omnibus on it. Boy, it was a big project and it opened and then the railways were invented and it like became obsolete pretty fast. The St. Lawrence Seaway still does a lot of traffic, but
because it goes to the Atlantic, not to Albany.
Right.
I think that might be the big difference.
Well, but then Albany connects to the river, you know. During the age of the railroad, and particularly like later on in the 19th century, it was recognized that this little narrow place here on the Detroit River between those two lakes was the logical place to have the railroads cross.
How close is it? That's the narrowest point, right?
It's the narrowest point, and it's, you know, as we'll see, it's about 2,000 feet across the river there. So mm-hmm. it's not a narrow span.
No.
And a difficult span to bridge. The first railroad bridges were proposed in the late 19th century. The initial idea, I think, was to build a tunnel. What the railroads were doing prior to that was the train line would arrive there in Detroit. They would put the trains on barges, barge them across, and then put them back on the rails in Windsor and send the train, you know, the trains up to Toronto.
Do you think the engineer stayed in the train?
Towards east.
On the boat? Was he like, toot, toot? No, they'd put a new engine on.
A new engine on either side. I bet you they still do that. The Alaska Maritime Highway puts whole trains on barges here in Seattle and ships them up and takes them off the other side. Or at least did when I was a kid, I think probably still do.
Are they now just taking containers off of flat cars, probably?
Yeah, maybe. It's probably not big barges full of boxcars like it was when I was little.
Barges full of boxcars.
But it was a choke point, and it was recognized that this was a real, you know, this really slowed commerce. And the shipping interests that were using the Detroit River going north and south, bringing barges through as part of the St. Lawrence Seaway, they were not inclined to give any quarter to the railroads that were running barges east and west across the river. You know, there was
the railroads are the enemy, right?
Right, a natural competition.
Yeah.
The first attempt to build a tunnel under the river was, you know, was sort of they started working on it in the early. Or I'm sorry, they started working on it in like immediately after the Civil War, 1870.
Oh, they attempted a tunnel before a bridge.
Yeah, attempted a tunnel.
1870. That's really early for a tunnel that long, right?
It was, and they didn't succeed. They got there and kind of couldn't finish it, and bailed out of it. In a little bit later, well, simultaneously, but like in the mid 1870s, they started discussing a bridge. The shipping interests refused to allow any plan that had piers in the river because it would impede the shipping passage.
Oh, you can go around a pier.
And so, you know, what it required was a suspension bridge that spanned the entire river, mm-hmm. which was technologically just to sort of above their pay grade at the
time. Yeah, at the time. Like, what's the early suspension bridges? I mean, the Brooklyn Bridge is later, right?
Well, that would have been...
around the same time?
Sure, 1880s.
70s or 80s? Looks like it's about the same time. They started building the Brooklyn Bridge in 1869, and it wasn't completed until the 1880s.
But the East River is a much smaller span. The Brooklyn Bridge is... How great a span is it? Also, the Brooklyn Bridge has piers.
The main span is between those two piers is 1600 feet.
1600.
Yeah.
So this would have been a longer span than that, and they weren't able to put together a consortium of financing for it. It was sort of a pipe dream for a long time. In 1910, the Michigan Central Railroad and the Great Western Railroad sort of combined forces and were able to build a railroad tunnel under the waterway. But there were a lot of other railroad interests that converged at that point that were sort of kept out of. I mean, this was a private undersea railway and not one that had been made available to everyone.
And it's international, right?
It's an international crossing.
It's a tunnel.
It is a tunnel. And in fact, it was the first tunnel ever to connect two nations.
Was crossing a border very informal back then? You didn't have to worry about...
No, I think...
There was no guy at a toll booth in the middle of the tunnel?
I think the opposite. I think crossing a border then, there was a Mountie there that wanted to make sure that you had enough provision to survive the winter. But this was only the third sort of tunnel of its kind and the first to connect two countries. So it was a big event, but it still didn't serve. There was no car traffic. There was no pedestrian side to it.
It didn't help anyone except one railway.
Except for Michigan Central and the Great Western. So it was not until after World War I that there was a renewed push to build a bridge. And the idea was Canada made a lot of sacrifices in World War I. The Canadians, the Newfoundlanders, the peoples of the maritime provinces, they made a great contribution in World War I, and a lot of men died. So there was an idea that they would build this bridge as a kind of memorial or a monument to the Canadian sacrifice.
Ah.
But this was also a time when Detroit was beginning to become an industrial center. It was the beginning of the American auto industry and the communities around Detroit and across the river in Windsor were. You know, all these factories devoted not just to making cars, but making all the material that goes into making cars, all the support network of things, you know.
I guess I never thought about some of that spilling across the border. But Windsor became a big Canadian industrial hub, huh?
It did. And in fact, there were a lot of auto makes that also were manufactured in Canada in Canadian factories. So you can buy American cars from this period, 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, the 20th century American cars that are Canadian made, have Canadian names, and look almost the same, but have slightly different headlights, taillights configuration.
It's like when you go to Costco and the TV or the washer dryer or something has a different number, so you can't actually...
You can't.
Comparison shop. The manufacturer is like, sure, we'll sell you these, but it'll have like a weird nameplate on it.
Is that right? Is that why I can't take my Consumer Reports page down to Costco? And
they've thwarted you.
Oh.
You want to look at your little Consumer Reports page with the little circles and the half circles and the red
circles? Yeah, give me the one that's the best buy every time.
No, Amana doesn't want you to do that.
Boo. So they did. They started working on the bridge sort of in that post World War I timepiece, and in 1929 they completed they bridged this span, and there was now an international bridge. At the time, it was the longest suspension bridge in the world.
Did you say what year it opened? I missed
1929.
And
it was only a few years later that the George Washington Bridge opened and surpassed the span, but it was briefly for.
Do you always feel sad? Like when Chrysler Building is only the tallest building in the world for like a few months?
It always seems like a little bit of a downer. Yeah, you're working on it and you're like, we're the tallest building in the world.
Happens in sports too. You know, some guy edges a record and then, you know, he only has it for a year.
Yeah, that, and I think that's what's so amazing about those records that stand for so long.
Yeah, those were people who were ahead of their time. Bob Beeman was an alien from the future.
But this bridge became a super important link between the United States and Canada. If you look at a map and you...
That's what I'm doing right now.
You look at Toronto and Chicago.
There's no other way around.
This bridge is the shortest distance.
Like really the option, if you don't have a boat, is to like drive up into the wilds.
Yeah. I mean, from Chicago, if you went all the way around,
you have to go around the top of Lake Superior, basically.
That would be crazy. But
that's what Google says if you're like, avoid tolls. Avoid tolls. Yeah. Okay. First, head up into Superior National Forest.
Now, there are other bridges across that gap between Michigan and Ontario.
That's what I was going to ask. Is there any narrower spot?
There are other bridges, other tunnels.
It must not have been. I mean, at the time, there must not have been because this was the Narrows. But since then, they have. There's a bridge at Point Edward, I see.
Yeah, there are other routes. They aren't the most direct route. And right in the center there is Lake St. Clair, which is a strange little...
Always been a thorn in my side.
Yeah, a little pond that you have to go around. And in the case of, if you're coming from Chicago, and this is all happening pre-interstate highway system, but now after the advent of the interstate highways, like if you're on I-94 or you're on I-75... and you come to Detroit, it is not handier to continue on those freeways all the way up to Sarnia.
So you got to go north of Lake St. Clair.
Right. So this is the direct connection. And it goes, I mean, the Ambassador Bridge goes from downtown Detroit to downtown Windsor. And in fact, on the Windsor side, it just empties out in that delightful Canadian way. Right onto the streets, like you get off, you're just like at a stoplight. And we see that here from Seattle going up to Vancouver,
right,
where you're on this
Oak Street or whatever it is that goes right through Vancouver.
You're on the freeway, you know, and then you're all of a sudden you're just like in Vancouver. There's no, they elected not to.
Yeah, the highway turns into, is it Oak Street? Is that what that is?
Yeah. They elected not to build a freeway through the center of town.
And so does it, I mean, if this is the artery between a major American city and a major Canadian city. I mean, is it a nightmare? Does that thing back up?
Well, it does. The Ambassador Bridge over time became such a necessary artery that today it carries, if you can fathom this, 25% of all trade between the United States and Canada.
Whoa.
Who are major trading partners.
So people don't understand this. Even in our time, Canada is our biggest trading partner by far, dwarfing China or anybody you would think of as our number one trade partner.
One quarter of that trade goes across this bridge. And which is astonishing and made more astonishing by the following fact. The bridge is privately owned.
Wait, what? Today?
It was built as a private enterprise, right? It was sort of funded by a group of people that raised the money to put it together.
And we're very sad about Canadian wartime heroes.
And Canada chipped in and America chipped in. And it was kind of freewheeling times before the stock market crash of 29. All of this was happening in the go-go years.
People were singing "We're in the Money" as they built this bridge.
And it was owned by the Bowers family for a long time, and they fell kind of on hard times at a certain point and took the bridge public, started selling stocks, and a little fellow that you may have heard of who runs a company called Berkshire Hathaway.
Oh, is that right? Warren Buffett controls the bridge?
Are you aware of this guy, Warren Buffett?
Does he live in a little house above the bridge like the people that raise the basketball bridges here in Seattle?
Warren Buffett started buying stock in the bridge because he is part of his...
He's a savvy guy.
He's a savvy guy, and he understands that transportation is...
25% of all trade to Canada.
Yeah. So he started buying stock in the bridge. This is now, we're talking about in the late 70s.
The bridge must be a toll bridge. Otherwise, it's hard to see what the profit motive is today.
Yeah, it is. It's a toll bridge.
It must just be a money machine.
Well, it is. In fact, it makes tens of millions of dollars a year. Mm. But at the time, the late 70s, you know, it was kind of a depressed time and things were sort of generally falling apart across the country. But a man by the name of Manuel Maroon, who was a Detroit trucking scion, his father was a Lebanese immigrant who owned a couple of gas stations in the Detroit area. And over the course of several decades, the family was pretty savvy. They sort of parlayed their gas stations into a trucking business. There were some cartage businesses, a hauling company that owed Manuel's father some money, and he ended up taking the trucking company over and then expanding it. And he became a hauling magnate for the area.
Self-made man.
That's right.
On hauling.
And his son, Manuel, took over the family business and recognized in the opportunity to buy shares in this bridge that because his trucking business was very auto industry focused. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of trucking of parts and services back and forth between Windsor and Detroit.
What about those big car carriers? I love those.
I'm sure they had car carriers. I'm sure he had, but also I think they're making, the auto business is so diversified, right? There's a factory that's just making the handles to roll the windows down on Chevy Caprices.
Probably not anymore.
But all of those parts and services need to get schlepped.
It's rubber, and then it's related stuff to run the factories. So,
and so Manuel made a play for the bridge because he just sort of instinctively recognized that owning the bridge, if that was really an opportunity for one of the trucking companies that's doing this business, it probably would give him an advantage over the other truckers.
Possibly an illegal advantage, right?
Like, well,
stop charging tolls to your own trucks, jack up the tolls on the other trucks.
The thing is that the bridge is not a monopoly because
there's the tunnel, right?
There's another tunnel called the Detroit Windsor Tunnel.
Right, that's
opened
what I'm looking at.
In 1930, that was a car tunnel, and so
it's a duopoly, though.
Yeah, the car tunnel opened and there was now a different route for car traffic to take. Now, the tunnel has all kinds of restrictions on freight. You can't take explosives and also I think there's a lot of limitations on any kind of trucking you can take through there, commercial trucking.
Size-wise?
But you can drive cars. And so technically, the bridge doesn't represent a monopoly. But from the standpoint of trucks and trucking, it's really the only viaduct there. Mm-hmm. And so Maroon does does some stock buying. He ends up with about a quarter of the stock in the bridge. Buffett has a quarter of the stock, and Maroon just sort of outplays him.
What a Maroon.
I know. He buys Buffett out and ends up owning the bridge. He bought it for about $30 million at a time when it was probably making close to that in tolls just in a year.
Seems like a good buy.
It was a good buy.
Why didn't I hear about this?
Well, in 1979, you didn't have as much money to invest.
I was 5 years old. Yeah. Like many five-year-olds, I did not have $30 million to put into bridges and tunnels. Do you remember a couple years ago when the Silver Dome was for sale?
No.
Yeah, you'd have to assume the debts, but like the Pontiac Silver Dome was for sale for like $90,000 or something. And I was just like, do I want the Silver Dome? Like, we all have to look ourselves in the mirror and think, how much do I want to own the Pontiac Silver Dome?
I mean, you could have so many monster truck shows.
You could reenact WrestleMania 3.
Boat shows. I think about this all the time in terms of wanting to buy a castle in Scotland. Mm-hmm. You can get a castle in Scotland for not that much money. But then you own a castle in Scotland.
It's the upkeep, John.
It really is.
You know what the two best days are for castle owners? The day you buy the castle and the day you sell the castle.
Right.
It's what we say in the castle business.
You know, just think about like running a broom over that thing. Like as soon as you get done sweeping it, you have to start at the top and sweep it again.
A castle is a hole in the Highlands you pour money into.
Well, this bridge ended up being a bridge in the Detroit-Windsor area that poured money into you.
Me? Personally?
Not you, but into Manuel Morone.
Okay. You're speaking to me as if I were Manuel Morone. It's kind of a little play acting thing we're doing.
Yeah.
Role playing.
It's a little role playing thing.
Maybe, I'll be a Lebanese American investor Manuel Morone.
If you could be a little shorter and a little more litigious, you'd be a great character.
You can be Warren Buffett and you can feel like you got hosed here.
The thing about the bridge is that when it was built, there wasn't an interstate highway system. There was not a sense of traffic being this unimpeded flow. Yeah.
It wouldn't have felt like an oddity for some guy to build a bridge and own a bridge.
The
London Underground was built by private companies who owned those lines.
That's right. But at a certain point, there was a kind of, with the London Underground or with a lot of these private ownership of public works situations, where some eminent domain factored in and governments recognized, like, we need to nationalize, you know, in some cases, we need to nationalize the underground in order to standardize it. Some nations like to nationalize the entire oil industry.
Are you a Hugo Chavez skeptic on this show?
when you depose a Shah, for instance, you know?
Right.
But in this instance, the respect for private property and the litigiousness of this man, despite a lot of growing outrage that this choke point was controlled by a single kind of eccentric.
Is he going to turn into a Bond villain and close the bridges like the Joker?
Well, not that.
Or
but
Bane, I guess.
But as the interstate system expanded, it did not ever fully connect to the Ambassador Bridge. So sort of like the interchange in Pennsylvania.
Breezewood.
Breezewood.
CF Breezewood.
We see a situation where, although this bridge is handling 10,000 trucks a day, on the Canadian side, it just dumps them out into downtown Windsor. Now, Windsor, Canada is sort of...
I've never been.
It's kind of famously...
Is it a dump?
Not the crown jewel of Canadian cities.
I've annoyed Canadians once this year. If you want me to be the one to say Windsor's kind of a dump.
You are already reviled by Toronto Blue Jays fans
far and wide.
And, you know, Detroit isn't really America's
fair enough,
hottest city either, although it's coming up.
It will be in 5 years once the vines cover everything and then the coffee bars come in.
No, that's all, you know, they're tearing the vines down. They're sprucing it up, and we'll see that in a minute. But there were many, many attempts to build what were called gateway plazas that were going to direct traffic onto and off of the bridge.
On the Canadian side?
On the American side and Canadian side. But they were thwarted by Manuel Morone.
Why does he not want his bridge to be welcoming?
Well, because he controls the duty-free shops on either side.
Is that true? Oh, my gosh.
And controls the duty-free gas stations. Now,
why are there duty-free gas stations?
Well, that's a really good question.
This was negotiated in the...
It's just a quirk of the way the land on either side is owned and the way it's administered. But you know, there's a thing called the International Fuel Tax Agreement, which is
IFTA.
Yeah, IFTA. A complicated kind of math that interstate truckers have to perform when they go from Canada to the United States and from state to state, because every state taxes gasoline in a different way. Nations tax gasoline in a different way.
These guys are all math wizards.
Well, and so trucking used to have this sort of really burdensome system where they had little tax certificates for each state that they traveled across and were paying different taxes. And at the end of the year, they had to figure out what taxes they'd paid in 25 different states that they'd traveled and Canada.
This actually speaks to me. Because like when I go talk at a if I do a little event at a university in Nebraska, I actually declare that and I will pay state tax to the great state of Nebraska, even though there's no way they would find me if I didn't. So at the end of the year, sometimes I'm filing 20 different state tax returns and I feel like a rube.
I do it too. I pay California taxes on things I do down
there.
Well,
they get you.
And they sure do. but also when we used to tour in Europe a lot, like we had to pay European taxes, and we also got exempted from some taxes, and the UK and Ireland have different rules. And so tax time, you've got all these pieces of paper, all these taxes you paid to different places.
You could be one of these tax dodging rock stars.
Yeah, I know.
What are you thinking?
Should have been. Well, we made just enough money that we were over the line of like, you're visible now. You can't just like stuff it in your underwear.
You can't just run to France like Mick and Keith.
But so the International Fuel Tax Agreement was one where truckers needed to keep track of where they went, but they didn't have to keep individual track of their taxes. And at the end of the year, at the taxes they paid at different pumps, at the end of the year, there was sort of an average was taken. How many miles did you travel? How many states did you cross? Here's your tax bill. And then we're going to apportion the tax out to the different jurisdictions. But Manuel Marone's gas station there at the edge of...
is it just one gas station with a huge line of cars snaking back into Canada?
Big superstation. He was able to... Because the taxes that are being paid on gas stations on either side are about 60 cents a gallon. He was able to charge a few cents less, still make his gas the cheapest in the region, but he's basically taking the 56 cents of tax.
He doesn't mark down 50 cents.
No, he doesn't.
And let the cars line up.
No, he takes all that. He takes that additional, what I think the jurisdictions around him think of as the tax dollar, and he just puts that directly in his coffer. So it's pure profit for him. So he had very little interest in helping Canada or the United States direct traffic smoothly on and off his bridge.
He wants you to stop at the stores and buy Toblerone.
That's exactly right.
And
and duty-free
Gordon's
whiskey.
Gin, yeah.
And then fill up your gas can. He has two companies, one called the Detroit International Bridge Company, and then the Canadian side has a company called the Canadian Transit Company. They're both part of his Centra Incorporated empire. So he has political entities on both sides that advocate for it.
Do his will.
It's been recognized for a long time that this is an untenable situation, and it really sticks in the craw of governments on both sides.
Especially Canada, I would assume.
Incredibly. Just really, really sticks in their craw. And they've tried to do, they've tried sort of everything. They've tried to...
just build a second nicer bridge right next to it.
Well, you know what? That is ultimately their plan.
That'd be hilarious.
The problem is that what we forget in the United States a lot as Canadians kind of puff up their shirts and talk to us about their liberal democracy and their free health care is that Canada is full of conservative Tea Party wing nuts, just like the United States. Anti-tax people, crazy sort of like gun toting. I mean, they don't tote guns
like
quite the same way.
But 20 minutes outside of any major Canadian city.
And so there's been a lot of resistance to the idea of building a huge government bloated project to
duplicate something that's already working.
To duplicate this working thing just to cut out this guy who's making an honest buck. What happened at 9/11 really... put in bold relief the problem, which was that everybody saw immediately, I mean, within an hour of 9/11, attention had turned to the Ambassador Bridge because of its like rare position as the kind of economic linchpin. If you wanted to do damage to the American and Canadian economies, all you'd have to do is take down this rickety old steel bridge, and we're talking about billions of dollars a week in revenue lost. And so the bridge became...
Too bad people were fixated on the skyscrapers.
Well, I know. There were a couple of things they could have... the 9/11 hijackers, again, I'm not suggesting that you try this, but there were a few places they could have targeted.
I get the symbolic value of a big phallic skyscraper, but they really were fixated on it, you know, from the before the truck bomb in the 90s, just this, what we think of as kind of an ordinary American skyscraper, maybe because it has World in the name?
It's World Trade Center. but you know, the hijackers wanted to blow up the Pentagon because, I don't know what, because it was like an FU. Mm-hmm. But if they had directed a plane to the Ambassador Bridge, they would have done a lot more harm. So the Ambassador Bridge suddenly became a security concern, and the state of Michigan National Guard flooded on there with machine guns. All of a sudden, they needed to stop every single car and truck before it went over the bridge to search it to make sure that it wasn't filled with explosives. And so in the months after 9/11, the line to cross the bridge was 12 hours long.
Oh, man, you miss that kind Mountie.
You really do.
The kind Mountie era. The KME is over.
And I remember it too. I remember being on tour before 9/11, where you drove into Canada and you didn't even really put on the brakes. You just kind of waved and they were like, howdy, neighbor. And then after 9/11, where all the Canadian border guards were dressed in black camo with like submachine guns, and they were like, get out of the car. You're in a band, you say? What kind of band? But the tunnel too, you know, this was a choke point on both the tunnel and the bridge. But again, all the truck traffic really had to go across the bridge. And so in this moment, the recognition that it wasn't just that this was a monopoly, but the bridge is extremely narrow. It's not a six-lane highway bridge, right? It's like it's a bridge that was built in 1929.
Oh, yeah. I guess it's just two each way?
It's two each way. And so it was, you know, traffic was down to one lane because of Marone's resistance to build these plazas, there wasn't room or any setup to build a giant sort of...
You still see it in airports that had no place to put the TSA, the new TSA stuff.
Right.
So stuff spills down... Like in Newark, it spills down the side of a hallway, you know, because there's nowhere to put the line.
Yeah, remember that period when they were just putting false walls up and like, right. Okay, well, this side is secure and that side's not. That used to drive me crazy.
What's the backup like on this bridge today?
It's still 4-hour wait to get across the bridge at certain times.
Good thing there's podcasts.
I know, right? I'm sure there's someone listening to this show right now waiting in line on the bridge.
Sorry.
But the United States and Canada finally arrived at a plan to build a replacement bridge. I'm sorry, a second bridge.
The Screw You Manuel Marone International Bridge.
That's basically what it was. And they built it all the way, sort of, they built it quite a ways away.
Next two is funnier, right?
Well, Marone said, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name properly. It might be Maroon, but that would be, you know, I don't want to open you up to make What a Maroon jokes again, over and over.
I think it probably is Maroon.
Maroon.
Yeah. Like Haroon. Yeah.
Manuel Maroon. Let's go back and we'll just take us saying Maroon. And we'll just slice that back in. And every place, it'll be like one of those recorded messages where it's like, Manuel Maroon.
Mr. Brown.
he sued... to block the construction of a new bridge. And he said, I will privately finance the construction of a neighbor bridge to my bridge, like build a brand new one, and I'll pay for it myself. All you have to do is, you know, whatever, build porta potties at each end, which really sent the Tea Party people on both sides of the river alight, because they're like, here's a guy, a capitalist guy, who's going to build it for free, and yet you know...
big, inefficient government wants to do it your way.
That's right. Wants to just build, you know, pay tax dollars for something that somebody else wants to do. But his lawsuits, which had always been pretty effective in defending himself against government intrusion into his own business, he wasn't able to block the construction of this bridge. And he used all kinds of unscrupulous techniques. He had
fake environmental review and stuff like that.
He did that. He went down and his like operatives from his company hammered eviction notices on the doors of all the houses in the neighborhood that would be kind of in the off-ramp area.
Oh, wow.
Like fake eviction notices where people came and, you know, like were meant to immediately call their congressman. It turned out that one of the things he didn't have to do, this was just like a trick of fate. On the Canadian side, the approach to the new bridge was the habitat, one of the few habitats and the only one in Canada of the endangered Butler garter snake.
So we've got our very own spotted owl.
That's right.
In
so
this story.
The garter snake, the Butler garter snake is largely indistinguishable from the common garter snake.
It just belongs to a butler. It comes on a silver tray.
The differences are that it's a small-headed snake. It has a small head. And I don't know if you've ever had a small-headed cat or mm-hmm. seen a small-headed cat, but it's an abomination of nature.
You don't want to see
and
that.
I don't want to see a small-headed snake
it's
either.
Like it's a pin-headed carnival freak.
The other thing about the Butler garter snake is that when it feels endangered, its method of escape is not to run, but is to just sit in place and thrash around.
Oh, I think I see why it's such a threatened species. it's all coming together.
But there are very few populations of it, and it is it's even
it's certainly extinct in the future. So
or the future or futurelings are just butler
garter
snakes.
Maybe this was the bridge thwarted bridge project that kept them alive, and they took over the ecosystem.
Well, it turned out they didn't want to stop the bridge program, and again, this is another thing that gets called out by people who are given to conspiracy. The government of Canada hired biologists to relocate the Butler garter snakes out of this little area.
Just stomp in; they all start wiggling in place.
That's right. Grab them, throw them in a bag. I mean, they're garter snakes; they're not going to hurt you,
right?
But that again seems like. Seems like an awful lot of sort of government pork barrel.
The free hand of the market, John, would not have had to move garter snakes.
But they began construction of it. And what the governments had the ability to do was to reroute their highways to their new bridge. And so...
They have the power to put a sign up. Like, it's like the fake eviction notice. They can put up a sign being like, dangerous privately owned bridge this way.
Ontario Highway 401... And so I should say, full disclosure, I've been across this bridge many times. I've been in the tunnel many times on tour in my rock band. And Ontario Highway 401 is this highway that's basically the main artery of central Canada. And it goes from Windsor to Toronto and then into Quebec. And it's a very frustrating Canadian version of an interstate, which is to say... the thing that is most frustrating about it is that the speed limit is 100 kilometers an hour the entire distance, which is, for those of us using imperial weights and measures, 62 miles an hour. And it's just a...
It's the fastest anyone has ever gone in Canada.
It's a road from one place to another, and it goes, you know, you think of Canada... This southern part of Ontario, it's where the majority of the population of Canada lives... But you can be on Highway 401 and drive for hours and just never see another living soul. But it isn't; it's not quite an interstate in the American sense of it just being like a superhighway. It's sort of more like what we would call a state highway, or in portions. Right? There are other portions that are built up,
and it looks like it just ends by an aluminum plant by the Detroit River.
It does. And in fact, in Toronto, within the city of Toronto, Highway 401 is the busiest road in North America.
I've heard that. Yeah, I've been on it.
Yeah, I mean it's a true highway there, and a big fat one. But out in the country, it's just a place that trucks go. But the Canadians have been routing 401, and on the American side, they've been routing I-96 and I-75 toward this new bridge. And building giant plazas and giant access roads to it, all the while being sued by Maroon.
So they can't build the actual bridge.
Right, but they are, but they're building these sort of what people love to call highways to nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the only way through is through poor, long-suffering downtown Windsor.
He's a troll. He's literally a troll with a bridge. And he's making everybody answer riddles.
And he is making, they're estimating that the new bridge will make $70 million a day in toll revenue.
Jeez.
Not a day. $70 million a year. I'm sorry. $70 million a day, that would be ludicrous. But
I'd build the bridge for that.
$70 million a year.
I'd just build it and tear it down in a week. I got my $490 million.
That's right. Good. What the hey? What the hey? It's like you can't lose.
I'm good to go.
That's so dumb, I can't believe that I said it. But $70 million a year.
Is there a completion date? Or?
So there were a lot of lawsuits. There was a lot of, just your typical kind of, what are we going to do about this garter snake? What are we going to do about who's going to own this? The government of Canada and the government of the United States arrived at an agreement where they would join forces to build a bridge. Canada would get the tax revenue from the bridge for the first 50 years after completion, because they would be putting in, they'd be making a larger investment in the construction. But the United States had the candy bar concession.
It's back when you would imagine the United States would exist in 50 years. They might want to renegotiate that today.
So they began construction on the new bridge in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
The completion date is 2024. It's going to be an enormous bridge. It's going to be a 2,800-foot span, but it's going to be one of these new style.
And that's the width.
That's the, 2,800-foot width. It's a cable-stayed bridge, so it has that sort of A shape,
right.
A giant sort of cable in the middle, and those are very elegant bridges. Very, very bridges of their time, though, right? I mean, 50 years from now, you're going to look back at those cable-stayed bridges and say, was that built between 2005 and
those were trendy
2015? And they struggled with what to name the bridge. They sort of figured that they were going to call it something like the Detroit International Commerce Collective, and they realized it's spelled Dick. There was a couple of problems like that where they couldn't settle on what to name it, and eventually they decided to name it the Gordie Howe Memorial Bridge. Because
that seems like a joke.
It does seem like it.
Yeah, the guy that died from the tragically hip Memorial Bridge. Like that sounds like something that guess it unites America and Canada, right?
No, not Gordie Howe, the tragically hip singer.
No, that's a different Gord. But I'm just saying it's a name you would choose as a punchline for what a Canadian would name a bridge.
Right. Well, but the thing about Gordie Howe is that although he's like a great son of Windsor, Canada. He played most of his career for the
Red Wings.
Detroit Red Wings. Yeah. So both sides, Ken.
It's the
both
one thing.
Sides.
It's the one thing that Detroit and Canada can agree on.
Everybody high-fived themselves all around. Although
the Gordie Howe sure was great.
The Gordie Howe Memorial Bridge does seem like it seems like something from SCTV. What's interesting right now is that by some quirk of SRO Google ranking, if you put in Detroit Bridge into Google, into a search engine, you get the Ambassador Bridge. If you put Detroit Bridges, the first thing that pops up is the Gordie Howe Bridge, and it pops up like a big, like, would you like to map to here? It has the whole suite of internet validation, like the Gordie Howe. Are you looking for the Gordie Howe Bridge?
Even though it does not yet exist.
It does not exist, and for 5 years will not exist.
Vaporware.
But they have begun.
They've built the entrance plazas.
They have.
On the internet as well.
They've begun the project of X-ing out the Ambassador Bridge and eliminating Manuel Maroon's sort of oligarchical hold on commerce in the Western sphere. The thing is that they can't take away his 2-cent discount on gas.
And that concludes Infrastructure Week here on the Omnibus. The Ambassador Bridge, entry 039.EZ4705, certificate number 36634 in the Omnibus. In the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, you can find the archives of our work at Omnibus Project on any platform you can think of. John was at John Roderick. I was at Ken Jennings. Hopefully that stuff survives to see the completion of the bridge in, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, 5 years.
But it's not a lock for sure.
I mean, it's not done until it's done. Until you break that champagne, until you cut that ribbon.
Also,
Manuel Maroon could, I mean, Manuel Maroon is an old man now, but he's got a son who's also, he also knows a bunch of lawyers.
He outlived Gordie Howe. I guess the thing is that Gordie Howe died in 2016, probably right around the time that they named the bridge. So that's the time of maximum Gordie Howe grief.
That's right.
In Detroit and in Greater Canada.
Yeah, they could have named it the Brian Boitano Bridge, but...
Elvis Stoico International Plaza. I was in Volunteer Park in Seattle the other day, and I was reminded that the park was built on the eve of World War II, but to honor the last veterans of the Spanish-American War.
Yeah, that's right. Those were the volunteers.
Who are, you know, I bet a lot of cities have volunteer stuff named for the Spanish-American War volunteers.
Well, any city that has a Union Park, a Union Plaza, Union Station, those were all named during or immediately after the Civil War.
So the Civil War, we still remember.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
Spanish-American War.
But I was kind of thinking, this is a little, the nostalgia here for the Spanish-American War is, it did not really pan out.
Well, cities like Seattle that in 1896 were just experiencing their first flourish, they're looking for their version of Union Station, right? They're a little bit late to the party to start calling things, you know, the General Grant Elementary School. So it's like, what have you done for me lately?
I do like the idea of putting up new statues to General Grant or whatever, just to counteract the Confederate statue thing. If they won't tear theirs down, do what the government's doing. Build a second bridge.
That's right.
Build more northern statues.
Put a statue.
Put them on public land in the middle of Atlanta and Memphis. And
a statue of Sherman.
Yeah, right in the middle of Savannah.
facing Robert E. Lee across the same plaza. Just General Sherman with his hand. In his jacket.
And it's like the volcano in Vegas that goes off every hour. He shoots a flamethrower at General Lee every hour.
We do that? He has a confetti cannon that just poof.
It's like Vegas Vic, the big neon cowboy, but it's General Sherman. John was on Instagram as well. On Facebook, a thing we all deplore. There was one bright shining corner of it for the Futurelings. We encourage you to look up that Facebook group or its analog on Reddit. You could send us physical artifacts via email. John basically has a side business reselling your dead grandparents' stuff on eBay.
Yep.
So make sure to send him all the cool stuff from the attic.
Listen, you know, I just bought a mid-century modern house. And so although I would love your father's or grandfather's pocket watch.
What you want is your dad's Eames chair, right?
I do. I want some Eames chairs. I want any kind of old bullet-shaped light fixture or Sputnik-oriented house accoutrement.
If it's in your house and it's shaped like Sputnik and you haven't sent it to John, you're not a real fan. You're
any kind of
fan.
Apollo or Gemini or Mercury space program ephemera.
If it looks kind of like a monorail, please send it to John Roderick, care of Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 985155. You don't have to send me any of your junk. I'm good.
No, Ken's fine.
You could send us email if that's the more convenient way. Like if you want to send us a photograph of your Sputnik-shaped stuff, you could do that. Send that to theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Really, the best way to support this endeavor and the time capsule it provides of knowledge to the people of the future, who otherwise will not know who Gordie Howe is, would be to donate of your substance. Please, if you can make any kind of financial contribution, we would really appreciate that, and it would ensure the longevity of the Omnibus. You can do that at patreon.com/omnibusproject. We're so grateful for those who have already done so.
We truly are. Thank you. And we're going to start rolling out bonus content for our Patreon donors, and I think we've
may have already happened by the time you hear this? Tricky.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's right.
A just part bit of the part of the omnibus time paradox.
Time conceived. Is a flat circle. I should mention that that Manuel Marun also he owns a wide variety of businesses. And for,
please tell me it's a chain of strip clubs.
No, as far as I know, no. But he did for a long period own the Michigan Central Station, the old decaying railroad station the center of Detroit. Do you remember it? You've seen it?
I've been to that part of town. I don't know if I've ever been in the station.
Well, you wouldn't have been in it.
Oh, you can't?
It's a 13-story building that until recently was completely blown out. All the windows were gone. It was, you know, it was crumbling into the ground. And Marun bought it at a time when he could. I went to that station when it was still an operating train station. The first time I went to Detroit was 1986 and was traveling by train. So I saw it in its crumbling decline. Marun bought it. Amtrak moved out in 88. I guess he bought it after that. And he's one of these negligent landlords, right? He just let the station fall apart. He owned the Roosevelt Warehouse, which was this giant old beautiful warehouse right in that same neighborhood, mm-hmm. just let it fall completely to ruin. He just recently sold the central station to Ford. And Ford is has
a
plant.
Are they actually going to put a plant there?
Yeah, not a plant. They're rehabilitating it as, you know, like a lot of these businesses now are getting into real estate because that's really all they have. like Sears can't make a living as a department store, but they own
a lot of land,
like trillions of dollars of
condos and yoga studios on.
Right. So Ford has put windows back in the train station, but that for people who have been to Detroit, that's a real landmark, and it's a real symbol of like just the disaster that was Detroit, and now I hope the rehabilitation that's happening there.
It's really tying into the Juggalos entry.
It really is, man. Detroit, it's where it all happens. Motor City. Futurelings, listen. From our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, how long the Ambassador Bridge lasted until it fell into the ocean. Marun is almost certainly dead by the time you hear this.
He may have been the last Lebanese person named Manuel. We have no idea.
We can't know. We also will be long gone. We'll just be memories. Maybe the Michigan Grand Central Station in Detroit is a world capital now. It may be like a Zeppelin docking station.
Probably.
There's no way for us to know. But we hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. And that bridge stands to this day and you can get whatever fuel of your choice, you can get your car recharged for 2 cents less a kilowatt.
And buy Kinder Eggs.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.